John, we're excited to welcome a new sponsor for this week, MailChimp. Two words, a direct order service that mails chimpanzees, monkeys, and gorillas directly to your door in old HelloFresh boxes.
PETA patent pending, MailChimp, two words, is perfect for 8chan incels searching for companionship or those in the entertainment industry. Hear from satisfied customer David Lynch, who recently used MailChimp, two words, for his Netflix short, What Did Jack Do?
Yes, David Lynch here. I absolutely love MailChimp tombworms. They're right on the money. What? It's David Lynch.
Get started today with MailChimp, two words. MailChimp, two words. They're not monkeying around.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Hop-Ons Podcast, a Twin Peaks review podcast sponsored by our Patreon supporters. For the second time, my name is Colin Cox.
My name is John Phelps. What up?
Hey, buddy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. John, we are here to discuss Season 2, Episode 14, Double Play. This episode originally aired on the 2nd of February, 1991, and it was The Big Loser at 5.6.
Eesh.
For a bit of context, the big winner was on NBC, Carol and Company at 13.6, followed by Dear John, part two of three at 12. Again, people do not say this enough. Excellent work by Dear John to retain that Carol and Company viewership. On CBS, on repeat, Throw Mama from the Train at 8.4.
Hell yeah, what a fucking terrible movie that is.
I had a feeling you would like that.
Oh.
John, this episode was written by Scott Frost with created by credits to both Frost and Lynch. And we have a new director for this episode, John. It was directed by Uli Edel.
Great name.
Excellent name. So he, of course, the celebrated German director, he came to prominence in the late 1970s as part of the East German Revolution. Would you like to know some of the credits on his IMDb page?
More than anything.
Sure. So we have, of course, and you'll know most of these, Das Ding, Der kleinen Soldat, Der Wild und der Zami Western, and of course the classic Der Harten Handel.
I have the criterion of that one.
It's fantastic.
It's so good.
Yes, I know. It's the plot is about as punishing as the German subtitles.
Correct.
John, the IMDb plot summary for this episode, Cooper reveals why Wyndham Earl is so obsessed with him and chess. Leo escapes. James is set up. Dougie Milford's brother faces his widow.
Oh, God.
Andrew Packer is back. Little Nicky's past is explained. Audrey strikes a deal with Bobby. Those are all singular, complete sentences.
Yeah, and there's even more that happens. It's a fucking big-ass episode.
It's a big episode. John, what did you think of this 14th episode of Season 2?
Weirdly enough, I found it to be pretty boring, apart from one little story, which is the most shocking to me, is the story I found the most interesting, is Leo Johnson's story.
It's really good.
Other than that, I found it to be a rather sort of boring, lollygagging is the word I want to use. It just sort of hangs out and doesn't seem to have, it's just very wheel spinning is how I feel.
Interesting.
A lot of this episode is. Even the stuff that happens with like, and stuff does happen, you know, the story does progress, but I don't care, and maybe it's because it's just not shot well or acted well. Like, James is real fucking bad this episode. Oh my God, he's so bad. But that whole thing wraps up more or less, and I just didn't give a shit about it. But the stuff with Leo I find fascinating. What about you?
I, perhaps in contrast, liked a lot of this episode. I found it quite compelling. Although, I will say this. This is something of a, funnily enough, speaking of Leo, this is something of a Frankenstein's monster
episode. Yeah, I was going to say that, absolutely.
Because the first 25 minutes of this episode are serious. There are aspects that feel like a horror film. And then this comedy ensues in strange ways. And so because of that, it felt oddly off balance, but I found myself enjoying more of this episode than I thought I would, maybe more than anything, and this is something that I thought you would like, because Bobby and Shelley's narrative is treated with weight and significance, and I thought you would like that.
No, I do, and I think the director, even though we did poke a little fun at him, maybe not the director so much as like the DP, is very good at lighting this episode. When the power's out, I should say. After that, it kind of returns to this normal sort of thing. But when the power outage, that's very like compelling stuff, and I really enjoyed it.
I completely agree. Yeah. So, John, let's just talk about some of the things that we found interesting and compelling about this episode. Sure. And maybe the best place to start is just at the beginning with this victim from the previous episode. The opening shot, funnily enough, it reminds me of this interrogation scene maybe from season one or early in season two when the camera pushed through those holes in the wall. Do you remember
it's
that?
Like episode two, I think.
Maybe. I think you're right.
It's really early.
The proximity to this victim is quite close. And tell me, did he look like Cooper to you? This victim.
Oh, I didn't think so. I didn't pay attention enough, though, I guess.
I thought, funnily enough, he looked like Cooper for some reason.
No, I didn't feel that at all. I do like that. I do like this sort of mysteriousness and backstory of this anti-Cooper is what I'll call Wyndham, because he seems to have all the charm that Cooper has, except he uses it in very sinister ways, I guess it would seem. But I like this a lot. I like we're seeing this sort of nemesis come out of almost thin air. It's like we solve the Laura Palmer case, and then we get Wyndham Earl appears out of the mist.
And that's something I certainly want to talk about, because I think this episode does some interesting work of introducing potential Leland Palmer antagonist replacements. And that's something that I think we should talk about, the degree to which the show has moved beyond Leland. And has it actually found an adequate replacement for him? Mm. Even though, and I think you would agree, we didn't necessarily know Leland was the antagonist. In a funny way, when Cooper says he still feels Wyndham Earl's presence, that's how Leland felt, I suppose, until he was revealed in episode 6. There was this presence of this villain or antagonist, but it feels like the show is maybe trying to find someone to compete for that spot.
Mm, that's a good way to put it, yeah.
Didn't this opening sequence feel like the Silence of the Lambs, funnily enough, with like bodies and things in people's mouths and just the desecration of the human body? I was thinking of that, too.
Yeah, the first big chunk feels a lot like a horror film. I guess the Cooper scene's a lot more of like your true crime thriller thing, like Silence of the Lambs. But then we like have the contrast with Leo, which is like Halloween, basically, is what this feels like.
I wanted to talk to you
about
that.
Some slasher film until he busts out, and then we get this Frankenstein's monster.
That's exactly movie. What I was thinking.
But you're right. It does have that. I think it just feels... I don't know how about you, but when I watch Silence of the Lambs, I can almost like smell things.
That's a really nice way to describe it.
But that's how I feel about this scene.
Well, so Demi does something. The Silence of the Lambs, funnily enough, was released in February of 1991. So that's an interesting connection.
Yeah, but absolutely.
The way Demi shoots that film, He uses close-ups in compelling ways. This is something that Jonathan Demme, you can see his fingerprints on his films in ways that you can with maybe directors like Tim Burton, perhaps, right? You can just feel a Tim Burton film. But because of how he uses close-ups, you feel part of an environment in an eerie and unsettling way. And that is a movie with some strange and unsettling environments. Everything from this cell where they keep Hannibal Lecter to even that sequence at Buffalo Bill's house where Starling is this is at the end of the film. Everything is in complete darkness and she's trying to find this person. You can almost feel the sweat and the body odor throughout that movie. I think you're right. Yeah,
and speaking of the way Demme uses close-ups, I thought there was a lot of super interesting shot reverse shots in this episode.
I agree.
Specifically, a lot with Cooper. They would frame like Trimlin would be like this medium shot, then Cooper would always be this super close. Mm-hmm. Like their eye lines would match, but that was about it. There was nothing else, and it's fascinating. But I wonder if he watched Silence of the Lambs. He's like, let's make that.
Well, it's funny because that this was clearly filmed before the release of the Silence of the Lambs. Sure. But it's funny again the release date proximity for that film in this episode because there are some similarities. There's a lot of darkness in this episode as well, which that's exactly what the Silence of the Lambs feels like to me, a very dark movie.
Yeah, so. Especially, and I guess like the Leo stuff's right after this.
Right, well, we have this really small scene with Bobby and Audrey, and she establishes herself as an authority figure, so to speak.
Like a kingpin. Where'd this come from? That's what I find fascinating.
We've built to this in some way, I suppose. So it doesn't feel so inconsistent, but she doesn't necessarily have a presence in this episode aside from this scene. But the Shelley, Leo, and Bobby sequence, which also feels displaced in some way because we just saw that sequence with Audrey and Bobby and he almost looks like he's dressed differently in some way. And even the way that whole sequence in Shelley and Leo's home is edited, I was thinking about some of these other spaces in Twin Peaks that seem to shudder a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about this house in that way because the editing is off. Like, I don't quite understand the geography of their house.
Well, I can, interestingly enough, I think they're going for like a, it almost feels like a found footage kind of horror film. Mm-hmm. And the mentioning Silence of the Lambs and thinking about the way that the light is used, especially with Shelley, like we get this like weird tunnel light where we just randomly might see her face or we might see like a reflection on the floor. Leo's always like just an outline, which reminded me a lot of horror films. Like Michael Myers is always the shape, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. That's what they call him.
When you think about a film like Nosferatu, the shaping of him in shadows is something that's really quite compelling.
And I love that they took Leo and he's not fully back to thinking yet, but they've made him speak and act in a manner that is a lot like Frankenstein's monster. Mm-hmm. Even so much as we jump to the end where he. The Twin Peaks, the town itself, pushes him to Wyndham Earle.
That's a great way to say it.
Who is more or less like Dr. Frankenstein at
exactly.
this point.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I like this a whole lot.
And you're right. He says this thing to Shelley before he tries to kill her. I think it's goodbye, wife.
Yes.
And that is such an odd phrase and an odd way of phrasing it. Again, almost as if he is this faux or quasi-human who's been pieced together and that he's not fully conscious maybe in the way that Bobby is, Shelley is, characters in the show are. He feels fractured in some way.
Yeah, and we should say like he only stops doing what he's doing because Shelley's able to get a knife and stab him in the leg.
Correct.
Which adds like a limp, which adds more to that whole Frankenstein.
It does.
Even physically.
Well, even thinking about him in that space, another reason why I was arguing, there's something about how this whole sequence is edited that seems to shudder or it collapses on itself. So when he reaches his hand through the plastic to try to grab Bobby,
that scared the shit out of me.
It frightened me too. But the way that's edited, he couldn't be there at that point.
Sure.
And I'm not trying to suggest that this is bad editing. I think it's all for a larger thematic point that there's something about this space that's almost collapsing or unfolding on itself. Maybe like the hospital in some way.
Yeah, I can buy that. I mean, I also just think that they're taking tropes from slasher films and, you know.
Oh, I think you're totally right.
Jason
too.
Will, you can see like 10 miles down the road, he's walking and turn back and he's right in your goddamn face, you know. And that's just what I
completely agree. I think it's interesting though how the sensibilities of slasher films, funnily enough, when applied to Twin Peaks, actually augments an idea or a theme that we've talked about before. It's like they don't need to do anything additional. It's just introduce this sensibility from a different genre, and it completely complements something that we've already talked about before. Mm-hmm. So I like how those work together without really doing anything extra, which is fun.
What did you read the owl shot like when he walks out and the CG owl flies into his face?
Oh, well, I think what you said a moment ago about how I think it only makes sense perhaps once you watch the end of the episode and you imagine that perhaps now Wyndham Earle is occupying that space that Leland once occupied because of how he is associated with owls and the woods and the forest. And it's almost as if this owl was beckoning Leo in some way, or marking him in some way. And I think that's interesting because we've talked about how it is like characters in Twin Peaks are marked. Some are marked as malevolent figures associated with the woods, with the owls, with the Black Lodge, and some are benevolent figures who are equally marked in that way. And so I can't help but think that it was maybe, as you said, just Twin Peaks marking him.
I do, and truly I do think that that sequence is the best sequence in the show, but that's just me personally. There's a quick murder, Little Nicky murder subplot.
Let's talk about the Little Nicky murder subplot.
Okay, sure.
We'll go ahead and get that out of the way.
Yeah, it's horrifically sad. It's so sad.
It is, but I have a note that I thought you would like.
Oh, sure.
I don't care.
Oh, great.
Which is funny.
Let's move on then.
It is, although I can't help, we talked about last time how if you are someone not unlike ourselves who likes Arrested Development, how can you look at Dick Tremaine and Andy together and not think this is a Job and Buster coupling? The way Dr. Hayward was reprimanding them, it almost felt a bit like how Michael would reprimand Job and Buster. So that is something I liked, but aside from that, I don't really care.
I don't care either. We find out ultimately that Little Nicky has a terrible life and it did not murder his parents, and that's all we find out.
No, it is nice to know that he did not murder his parents. So let's say a couple of things about James.
Can I read my note here first, please, about James? James is back at the old murder fuck palace. That's what I have down here. James is systematically brought in as the patsy.
Right, he's the fall guy
for Evelyn and her not brother to murder. I'm assuming by cutting this dude's brake lines or something. We don't really know.
Yeah, it's difficult to know exactly what's happened, but I suppose the implication is James has restored this car, but They've perhaps compromised it in some way without James knowing, so that when Jeffrey, in theory, dies in a car accident, they can blame James for it.
Right, and Evelyn tells James, "I've fallen in love with you," and I can assume he's been there for 3 days?
It's been a few days, sure.
And she's crying. She's very into James.
She does. Well, there's this wonderful sequence. This is actually really one of the funnier sequences when we meet Jeffrey, and I want to talk about him because he's wearing a tracksuit jumpsuit, not unlike Ben Stiller from the Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, yeah, he is. Yeah.
It's wonderful. But John, she's doing this thing. The camera frames the two of them. And Jeffrey's talking, and she's just doing this sultry, seductive thing. Like, she could just be thrusting her hips at James because that's the message she's communicating in some way to him in that moment. It was really funny. I thought it was actually quite funny.
I love that Evelyn is a character who goes to this bar called Hideout Wally's.
Yes.
And just sort of waits around for people to fall into her life.
No, I know.
And so much so that the bartender's like, oh, God. And when Donna's like, I'm looking for my biker friend, and he just looks at Evelyn and looks back at her and then just leaves. He's like, here's this dumb old Evelyn again.
Well, it is funny because I actually wrote a note that says, Evelyn, just drink at home. But I think you're right. The point is, her life is so boring that she needs to find people at this dive bar. And so she just goes and drinks all day.
And ultimately, she turns Donna to the house, I guess, or Donna maybe follows her.
Well, I think actually, because if you pay attention to the editing, she's actually trying to throw Donna off.
Oh, right.
She tells Donna that James left the day before, and clearly Donna doesn't trust her, I suppose. And
why would you?
Donna just waits by that tree all day, which that's a choice.
And then she goes, James, out of nowhere. She's just there, and he's like, oh, thank God. This is going to be real bad.
Deus Ex Machina, am I right?
I'm glad you were right here by this tree. I know. Have you been here all day? Yes.
Yes.
I'm quite tired.
I've had one cup of coffee.
My feet hurt immensely.
One cup of coffee. But so I did want to talk about a couple of things. I do think it's interesting and ironic that in this sequence, James is surrounded and flanked by all of these cars, both model and literal. And of course, cars and automobiles function as signifiers for freedom and mobility. But we're seeing yet again, especially at the end of this episode, how James is incapable, regrettably, of actually finding the freedom that he seems to want, even when, again, ironically enough, he does this work, which I suppose by design was to create the conditions for him to free himself, but it's only entrapped him more in some ways.
Sure, sure.
Also, I know that one of the points seems to be that Jeffrey's this figure who is fundamentally different during the day than he is at night, but he does seem helpless and innocent when we meet him.
Sure.
Which, in this respect, he seems to mirror Leland, perhaps.
Oh, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, I didn't think about that. He's the Leland of whatever this version of Twin Peaks is, I guess.
Yes, well, that's what I was thinking again, how Twin Peaks, the show itself, seems to really like this dichotomy.
Yeah.
This dichotomous idea about characters, that there's no synthesis in any way. They're either this or they're that, and they can theoretically occupy those spaces within the same person, but never at the same time. It's not like Leland and Bob were the same person ever. He would just switch in some ways. And it feels like Jeffrey's the exact same way, that he would just switch.
Why is it there's a moment that baffles me in this episode. When James is in the garage and he, the terrible song he sang with Laura and Donna's playing.
I remember that, yeah.
And he sits down and like he like at least feels like all the world's pressure's on him. Like he can't get up and he's just like crying. And in my brain, I was like, you could just leave.
Sure.
You could just go ahead and leave. And I don't understand why he doesn't.
So the first time I watched it, I thought it's because he knew that Jeffrey died, but that's clearly not true.
Yeah, because this is before
he doesn't learn that until later. Yeah, again, I don't know. Aside from perhaps the show is, again, trying to communicate how trapped James feels. And in that way, I do find him a sympathetic and compelling character because Cooper, by contrast, never seems to feel trapped in Twin Peaks. If anything, Twin Peaks, despite all of its deficiencies, is a space of freedom and liberation for him. But for James, it is perpetually a space that traps him. It seems its borders just seem to close around him the more he tries to free himself. And as we talked about perhaps last week or in the last episode and the episode before that, even when he thinks he's left Twin Peaks, the borders of the town just spread and then enclose around him in some way. Sure. And I don't know if that works at all for you, but
okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So we get this great little moment with Norma and Big Ed. Doc asks Big Ed if Nadine is sexually active. And Ed says, "Doc, I wake up every morning feeling like I've been hit by a timber truck." So I guess they're banging it out. And then I stopped and thought, is Nadine having sex with teenage boys?
Well, okay, we need to talk about this
because there's a lot going on.
So this is such an important scene, I think, for a couple of reasons. So I think you're right. The implication is that Ed and Nadine have rough, vigorous sex every single night. But Nadine, he and Hayward, or Ed and Hayward, are talking like two fathers of teenage daughters.
Oh, yes.
Because he's presumably talking to Dr. Hayward because, there it is, because he wants advice because Nadine wants to date boys. So what I was thinking, Ed is something of a figurative father to Nadine, who's his figurative daughter. And it is strange to me how Twin Peaks as a place is a space where people perpetually break one of society's most significant taboos, which is the incest taboo. And in theory, this is precisely why, at least this current iteration of the town, is in such peril because of what Leland did to Laura Palmer. But here, when Dr. Hayward and Ed talk, what was once a tragedy returns as farce because it's a joke.
Yeah, because Hayward even says, it's hard being a parent, isn't it? After Ed mentions James, but he's definitely talking about Norma. Nadine. Sorry.
Exactly. No, yeah. But that's exactly my point. It is strange to me how this breaking of the incest taboo seems to return as a joke now. But to this point, it's been nothing but something tragic.
Did you like how, and again, they are constantly framing Ed and Norma as characters from, like, Casablanca. That's what they do. And even in this episode, they're sitting at the diner across from each other talking about their dreams, and then this music, like, swells in, like this 1950s doo-wop, just for them.
Just for them.
And then after the scene cuts, it just fades out. And in my brain, I'm glad they're finally getting their shot. But now that I stop and think about that, it makes me question how I feel about Big Ed.
It is, again, he has fantastic lines, but I think you should. But I think more to the point, I'm less interested in Ed as a particular person and more interested, again, in just Twin Peaks as this space that seems to invite the breaking of this incest taboo. Either literally with Laura and Leland or figuratively and metaphorically with Ed and Nadine.
Yeah, wow. All right. Wow.
So can we talk about Cooper? Cooper explores with Harry some of his history with Wyndham Earle, and he describes this as baggage, that he's brought baggage to Twin Peaks.
Yeah. I loved it. Did you like this?
I did, because we've talked about this before. I like the idea of Cooper as perhaps not a messianic figure, but as someone who has made mistakes and as someone who is a beta to perhaps someone else's alpha, because Cooper just enters Twin Peaks and he seems like this alpha figure, right?
Yeah.
But in relation to Wyndham Earle, he's more of a beta than anything else.
Yeah, and this is where I think the shot reverse shot is a big deal, because they frame Cooper to be very vulnerable in this situation.
Yes.
And that's when they're very tight on him, and the angle looks a little, not directly on, but maybe a little from coming from above, looking down at Cooper. And we get this, like, sort of this transparency exposure of the woman Wyndham Earle's wife, Catherine, was that her name? That he, Christine, Catherine,
Carolyn, who looks a lot like Laura Palmer, by
does,
the way.
Yeah, that he had sort of fallen for. And I like that this is one of the first moments that sort of has ever framed Cooper as like a human.
Definitely.
With like humanistic qualities.
And, you know? And again, decidedly fallible as well. It also helps to explain some of his reluctance and trepidation with Audrey. And again, I think in particular when you consider the narrative he describes about Wyndham Earle, this is perhaps one of those moments where the show is actively trying to construct a new Leland Palmer villain, or a villain in the vein of Leland Palmer, because the way Cooper describes it, it is as if Wyndham Earle became possessed by something. And it's perhaps not the same as what possessed Leland, but it feels adjacent, perhaps.
I don't know if I...
You don't agree?
I mean, this is like his Joker moment, you know? Like, this is... Cooper is describing Wyndham Earle's worst day. And this is a situation where Wyndham Earle has sort of broken his sanity, finally. Like, this is what snapped it. And I don't think he's been possessed by anything. I think he was just maybe teetering on the edge the whole time.
Well, that's why I said adjacent and not the exact same. It's. I guess my point is, it feels as if the way Cooper wants to think about this is that something came over Wyndham Earle, whether it's something internal, which is decidedly different from what happened with Leland. Leland was possessed by something external.
Okay,
the external
sure.
became internal. Maybe this feels more like the manifestation of something internal. But what's funny is that Twin Peaks seems to be this place where people who do bad things only do them in relation to perhaps the influence of others. And you can define that word however you want. Others can be particular characters, or they can be quite literal malevolent spirits that possess them. Maybe the Renaults are the only difference mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. But when I think about characters like Wyndham Earle, Leland, it is as if something takes them in some way. Again, whether it's an external spirit or something internal. And maybe we can talk about this more the more we get to know Wyndham Earle. But
yeah, I think ultimately this episode makes Twin Peaks feel a lot more like a Gotham City to me. There's a lot more, like, even in the fact that I would go so far as to say, like, Wyndham Earle is now, like, I already compared him to the Joker. That's kind of what he is. The Riddler almost thrown in there too.
Yes, I think that's a good one. So Cooper almost has a rogues gallery in some ways.
He does. And even there's a moment when Major Briggs says, if you need me, I'll be in the shadows. As if
I want to talk about that. Yeah.
As if he's just sort of looking around things. But I like what you're saying. I do like this idea that Wyndham Earle is necessary for a town like Twin Peaks?
Necessary. I think that's a great way of thinking about it.
I think that's ultimately what it is, yeah.
So we need to talk about Ben and his attempts to win the Civil War. So I don't know how I feel about this. Dr. Jacoby is there.
I love
and
it. It's so fucking racist and bad, and it's like so embarrassingly bad that I genuinely enjoy it.
But this is also, I would argue, where the episode turns in some way. I had mentioned that there's a turn, and I think maybe this is it. So I don't know how I feel about this, but Jacoby seems to confirm my reading from the last episode, and I haven't watched these episodes, that for Ben to symbolically win the Civil War, it's a way of reinstating his sanity.
Reversing his defeat, as Jacoby puts it.
Yes, I actually have the line here. What he needs right now is both your understanding and a Confederate victory.
Yeah, and great shots, by the way, in this.
Fantastic.
The way they frame Ben as this like Confederate hero with this giant flag behind him. He has a fan in his office just for this moment, just in hopes someone snaps a picture of him with the flag waving behind him.
And I was about to say, all of this is augmented yet again by another reference to one of Shakespeare's plays, Henry V.
Oh.
It's Henry's St. Crispin's Day speech. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he who sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Ne'er he be so vile this day shall gentle his condition. I think I missed a little bit of it, but it's this rousing jingoistic speech that Henry gives to rally the troops to fight the French.
That's great. And I love there's a moment when Ben addresses Jerry as Jeb.
That is correct.
Jeb Stuart, who is a local boy.
That is correct.
For us. He's from Patrick County.
Yeah.
Which is very close to us. And I heard that and was like, hey, that's something to not be proud of, but
right,
there definitely. We are.
Yeah, and I have a note as well. What does it mean if Jerry is the reasonable horn? That can't be good. That can't be good at all.
There's a moment when, and then of course at the end of the scene, they sing I Wish I Was in Dixie.
Oh, it's awful.
Which is embarrassingly bad.
Yeah.
And I was washed over with how terrible it was.
Hey, it reminds me of my childhood.
People still have car horns that play that here.
So if we have it, because I know we have listeners who are located everywhere, geographically speaking, where we are in Virginia, we're in the southern part of Virginia, and we're very much in what would have been Confederate territory.
Yeah, so we are literally 10 minutes from Jeb Stuart Highway.
That is correct.
Which is what Jerry is named after.
And I've mentioned on several occasions that we have elementary schools in the district where I live named after Civil War generals.
Yes, so this is something that we have.
This is very much a thing we have.
Okay, so then we get this weird scene where everybody's chugging water. And it's so Lynchian.
Briggs is coming in hot, man. What is he doing?
And everybody's just, but Cooper's digging it. Cooper's like drinking his water. He sits it down. And Lucy's like, Maury is like, I'm good.
All three of them.
But why? What was the point? This like in media res chugging scene.
No, I think you're absolutely right. You can almost read this as David Lynch made a call and said, now I want them just to drink some water. It feels, you're right, it feels so distinctly Lynchian.
Everybody just drink. Why?
I want to see him drinking water. It's fine. I need to go. I'm making Lost Highway.
But the major then states more or less that he's kind of fed up with the Air Force. Like they're maybe keeping things from people they shouldn't be keeping.
He says he's convinced his superiors have perhaps questionable ideological motivations.
Oh, that's, wow.
Which is
very big words.
Perhaps coded language for, I don't think they are interested in this for the right reasons.
Right. And he suggests that he has been to the White Lodge and he will be sort of hanging out in the shadows as like this ever watchful, I don't know, guardian? It's funny,
can I tell you what I was thinking? Anytime I hear the word shadows, I think of Tolkien and I think of Lord of the Rings, because when people make reference to the shadow or shadows, it's always an ominous thing. So don't be taken by the shadow, mm-hmm. right? The shadow took me. I fell into the shadow. And I wonder if this just portends something ominous for Briggs.
Oh, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I like my reading of Briggs is like joining the Avengers or something.
Oh, wow. He's just, okay.
He's there. He's there if you need him kind of thing.
I like that reading too. Yeah,
because that's how it feels to me.
He's incognito, perhaps.
This feels distinctly comic booky to me.
Yeah,
all his stuff and Wyndham's stuff.
I completely agree with you. So we're still in the sheriff's station, and I think Lana, is that her name?
I have a lot of problems with this.
I have so many questions. First, did Jacoby fuck Lana?
Okay.
It is Lana, though, right?
Yes. She has a magic vagina. Let's get out of the way. Her vagina is magic.
Apparently so much so that even Cooper's
There's a seduced. Moment in this episode, and I love the police in this show. But they do the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. So they are exiting the room with Jacoby.
Oh, I think I know what you're about to
say. And the mayor, Dougie, has a shotgun trained on them, and he wants to just blow her away. He's got a great line. He says, anybody that moves, I'll blast her to kingdom come, and the hippie too. That was great.
That was wonderful.
And so Cooper's like, I think you two should go talk it out.
Sure.
And lets him walk in the room.
With the gun.
With a shotgun.
With the gun.
And they close the door up and sort of just hang out.
Can we talk about, there's another wonderful shot when, so it's a shot of the door before Cooper suggests that Lana and the mayor should talk. So Truman has his gun trained on presumably the mayor. Did you see how Hawk was holding his gun?
No.
Oh, it's straight up in the air.
Oh, okay.
So Hawk isn't even, and Andy just has hands in the air, basically. So one person has their gun trained on a guy with a shotgun who just threatened two people. Hawk's is pointed in the air. Andy's holding his dick.
Andy is not doing anything.
He's not doing a damn thing.
But there is this very, and I laughed out loud when they close the door and they wait, which is great. They just wait. You never see characters just sort of wait around. There's no cut. Then they go in, and the first thing Dougie says, we decided to adopt a child. I laughed so much. That is such a fucking great moment.
It's wonderful.
It doesn't make any sense, but it's very, very funny.
So you're right. Lana seems to have a magic vagina.
She has a magic vagina, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even so much so the way the camera's trained on her lower body at one point, it's just,
they're all like tractor beamed to her.
It's, I might have more to say about this later, but it is unsettling to say the least.
Okay, and then we get,
do you want to talk about Andrew Packard and Thomas Eckhart?
How much I don't care. Do you care? I don't care.
Well, I wonder if and maybe part of the reason why is because we haven't, We're seeing the beginning of this, not the end of it. But I wonder if in some ways this is meant to mirror Cooper and Wyndham Earls. rather antagonistic relationship with one another.
I would love to. Yeah, I mean, I wish that I had read it like that from the outset, so I would care more, because I don't give a shit. And weirdly enough, like the relationship that Catherine Martell seems to have with her brother. Again, let's talk about incest. They are two steps away from just fucking right in front of Pete.
That's exactly my point. It is strange to me how in two episodes, and not that incest hasn't been a theme in Twin Peaks, because it definitely has. However, that theme, the show has located that theme exclusively with Leland and Laura Palmer.
Right.
As if to suggest that, yes, it is awful, and yes, it is one of those taboos that you don't breach, but we've bottled it in some way into the relationship between these two characters. And it's as if once all of that is exposed, Twin Peaks becomes this place that is just riddled and overwrought with sex and incest, as if perhaps we didn't see it the whole time. Mm. Because it was so visible in such a troubling way with figures like Leland and Laura. But now what we're ultimately seeing is just how this, in many ways, regrettably defines this town. This town is defined by the breaching of this taboo, not the perhaps cloistering of this taboo off into maybe the scapegoat figures, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and ultimately, that's where the episode... Well, the episode ends with Leo sort of showing up at Wyndham's cabin.
Well, can we talk about Wyndham Earle for a moment? Because we don't get a lot of him, but we finally do see him, which I don't think we've seen him to this point.
Right. I don't know the actor's name, but he is incredibly watchable.
I agree.
Truly is. He's again, he's dressed in a suit, all black, if I can remember correctly.
I think that's right. It's almost as if he and Cooper wear the same FBI uniform in some way.
Right, but he's the anti-Cooper, so that's why he's all black instead of the white shirt, I guess you could say.
Yeah, or and even I don't think his tie is tied all the way to the top, his hair, whereas Cooper has this neat, polished pompadour. His is wild and unkempt.
Yes.
And
again, like if we go by my idea of this being like very comic booky, here is where he's sort of setting up his team and he's recruiting Leo Johnson.
I think that's a great way to think about it.
Who has been driven to him, and he doesn't question it. He's already fucking bonkers enough to realize that Twin Peaks has pushed this to him, so.
Or Leo, I think that's a great way to think about it. This is not so inconsistent for Leo Johnson, because he does seem to occupy this henchman role. He did that in season one. So this might almost, one could argue this is natural for Leo Johnson to want to hench. Mm. He likes henching.
He's a good hencher, yeah.
He's good at henching. That is correct. Yeah, so John, what are your thoughts about where the show will go moving forward? Do you think, because we've talked about with Arrested Development before how there were these distinct pivot episodes.
Oh, right.
And
right.
Is that a way of possibly reading this episode, that it's not unlike these references to chess, that we've set a board, so to speak. Mm. And if so, are you satisfied with how Twin Peaks has set its board?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people have many issues with where the show is right now. Again, it's the lowest rated, I think, of the season so far, is this episode.
Yes, that is correct.
I genuinely like it. I really do. I think it's still fascinating. And again, Twin Peaks has never really been about Laura Palmer. It's been about this vessel into this world that we get. And I do like it. You know, we don't have many episodes left of this, right? Like maybe 8-ish, I think.
Of season 2, that's right.
So there's a lot to sort of box up in 8 episodes. So yeah, I mean, I do like it. I do understand the negativity towards it, but I think that if you have a podcast about it or talk about the episodes one by one, I mean, you're going to find something to dig about it.
I agree. And plus, I would just say that Twin Peaks, because it's serialized television, while you're right, we often think that shows culminate with season finales, but the nature of serialized television is to not actually do that. It's to tease it out in some ways
and
to create more narrative opportunities. So I see the show doing that in a compelling way as well, that it's not driving toward a conclusion in some way. It's almost driving toward the unresolvability, perhaps, of just serialized television by introducing all of these new stories from episode to episode.
I think it would be fascinating if Lynch had been able to wrap it up the way he wanted to then, like in the 90s. So, yeah.
Interesting. Well, John, let us transition to some of our segments. From time to time, John and I like to celebrate some of the more bombastic performances in Twin Peaks. So now it's time for My Baby.
It's Ben, and I don't have to say anymore. What do you got?
Once again, Ben Horn. he is a madman who just keeps winning our My Baby awards from 1 week to the next.
Fucking nuts.
No, he is. But he is utterly spectacular in this episode.
He is, yes.
He really is quite good. John, best lines?
I've already said most. Let's see. I've got Doc. I wake up every morning feeling like I have been hit by a timber truck. It's a Big Ed line. I will be in the shadows if you need me. That's a Briggs line. Is it hot in here? That's a line that Truman says, and Cooper and Hawk answer, yeah, at the same time, looking at the magic vagina. Anybody that moves, and I'll blast her in a kingdom come, and the hippie too. We decided to adopt a child. Oh, a Pete line. We forgot the weenies. That made me laugh a lot.
I have that whole line.
And this is not a favorite line, but the way that James's actor reads, I can't stay here, it's wrong, and you set me up, is so bad. It's like Tommy Wiseau level of, I did not hit her, I did not.
No, it's James. He clearly exceeds his range in this episode.
Yeah, so what do you got?
Okay. Active Doc, I wake up every morning feeling like I've been hit by a timber truck. Love isn't wrong, James. That's something Evelyn says. I really liked that line. I don't know why. Your General Jeb Stuart. Oh, this is a series of Jacoby lines. What he's doing is quite healthy. And then, what he needs right now is both your understanding and a Confederate victory. Okay, well then, we're going to go bowling.
Oh, yeah.
Best line of the episode.
Jacoby line, yeah.
Anybody move and I'll blast her into kingdom come and the hippie too. And then I think the mayor also says horse dung at one point, which is funny. Hot dogs. We forgot the hot dogs. We forgot the weenies. All beef with the skin on them.
The skin on them.
And this isn't a line, but it's something that's on maybe a newspaper. Asian man killed with 3 exclamation marks. That's funny. Well, John, that's our conversation for season 2, episode 14 of Twin Peaks Double Play. John, we're recording a new episode of the Big Arms podcast tonight.
We sure are. I'm very excited about it. You don't know anything about it.
I know nothing.
Fully blind.
Indeed.
I came up with everything at work today. So
oh, fun.
Should be great.
Good.
What's happening on the Cluttered Desk podcast?
Well, the episode that I've talked about maybe over the last 2 episodes, I released that recently within the last week about Star Wars and queer baiting. Andrew and I, we recorded this episode many, many weeks ago about the 2013 Spike Jonze film Her.
Yeah.
I should have that out at some point in the next 2 weeks. It was a great conversation. Yet again, one of those few times when Andrew and I disagreed about something. He did not like the movie as much as I did.
Fascinating.
Okay. Yeah. So look for that. But aside from those 2 episodes, we're still very much in the middle of season 10. This is our movie-centric episode, and we're excited about it.
Nice, nice.
So, John, let's take a moment to remind everyone, if you haven't taken a chance to rate and review the podcast, we would love it if you would do that. And, of course, don't forget, we have a Patreon page. And John and I, maybe over the next 2 episodes, we're thinking of making some additions to some of the Patreon tiers.
Yeah.
So we're excited about maybe updating those a little bit. Not increasing the price or anything, but just maybe adding some features to some of the tiers.
Yeah, to maybe add a little bit incentive.
More incentives.
Yeah.
There it is. Well, John, for the Hop-Ons podcast, my name is Colin Cox.
I'm John Phelps.
Buddy, I'll talk to you next time.
Okay.